This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Jokes, the universe, and so much more. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. If you missed it, you can still contribute by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to broadcast live from the Inner City Blues Festival, Saturday, April 13th, from 7 to 10 p.m. Healthcare for All Oregon is throwing a party called the Inner City Blues Festival, Healing the Healthcare Blues, in the Groove of Love. Northwest Blues Stars are returning for a night of music that will benefit the work of statewide coalition Healthcare for All Oregon for universal, affordable healthcare for all Oregonians. KBOO is proud to help sponsor the Inner City Blues Festival to take place Saturday, April 13th at the Melody Ballroom, 615 South East Alder. Doors at 6, and KBOO's live broadcast starts at 7. More information can be found at kboo.fm/innercitybluesfestival2013.
KBOO's broadcast of this event will run 7 p.m. until midnight.
KBOO Community Radio continues the broadcast of the 2013 Illahi Lecture Series on Wednesday, April 24th, when we'll broadcast a talk by Catherine Austin Fitz.
Managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services, Catherine Austin Fitz is also a publisher of the Solari Report. She served as Assistant Secretary of Housing, Federal Housing Commissioner in the first Bush administration, and Managing Director of Wall Street firm Dillon Reed & Co., Inc. Fitz has designed and closed over 25 billion transactions and investments to date and has led portfolio investment strategy for $300 billion of financial assets and liabilities.
Catherine Austin Fitz will be speaking at the First Congregational Church in Portland, and KBOO will broadcast the talk live at 7 p.m. Wednesday, April 24th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/illahi2013.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of Palestine, imperialism, and the New Middle East, the Arab Spring 2 years on, a two-day conference at Portland State organized by Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights, held on April 27th and 28th. Speakers include Nadia Elia, professor of gender and global studies at Antioch University, Ahmed Maher, co-founder of Egypt's revolutionary April 6th youth movement, Remy Kanazi, Palestinian-American poet and activist, Cindy Corey, parent of ISM activist Rachel Corey, and Aaron Dixon, founder of Seattle's chapter of the Black Panther Party. The conference is located in Smith Memorial Student Union and registration begins at 9 a.m. each day. Child care and food provided. More information can be found on Facebook at Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights. Click on Events.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson, guest hosting today on a somewhat shorter version of Voices of the Middle East. Host Gudars Ektedari will be back on the show next month. Today, I'm speaking with Kathy Breen, who has volunteered with Voices for Creative Nonviolence for many years. She first went to Iraq in the fall of 2002 as part of the Iraq peace team, and she stayed on for 5 or 6 months leading up to the invasion, also through the Shock and Awe campaign. She returned to Iraq about 6 months into the occupation for another 3 months, and then last October, November, she returned again. Over the last 6 years, she has also spent time in both Jordan and Syria alongside of Iraqi refugees to witness their reality and advocate for their resettlement when desired. Kathy Breen, thanks for being with us today to talk about Iraq and the situation there.
You're very welcome, Kathleen.
As I mentioned, Kathy Breen recently returned to Iraq. That was in October, November of last year, and she wrote some dispatches from her time there. So I want to get a sense from you, Kathy, about what that was like, having returned to Iraq after, how many years had it been since you'd been?
Nine.
Tell us what that was like.
Okay, first I'd like to say that the reason it was 9 years is because we made a decision as Voices in January of 2004 that we could no longer return to central and southern Iraq because we would put Iraqis in danger by being associated with us, anyone. And so this was sort of a testing of the waters to see. We didn't, that's our, not only our own lives, but the life, you know, the security of friends and anyone with whom we would associate. So this was a testing of the waters, as I said, and it was a great dream come true, let's put it this way, for me. I had been with Iraqis in Jordan and Syria these at least 3 or 4 years, and over the last years in Jordan and Syria, working alongside of Iraqi refugees. But these were Iraqi refugees in Jordan and Syria who couldn't work, who couldn't study, who just wanted to go to a country and be safe. And resettlement was not an option in Jordan and Syria. And actually, quite a few Iraqis, families and individuals we know in Syria, from Syria, have had to return to Iraq because of the violence in Syria. And we were hoping also to meet up with them, which we did, several of them. So it was seeing old friends and making new contacts and... But I want to say that I went very quietly, and the pictures I took, for the most part, were taken surreptitiously from a car window.
Why surreptitiously?
Jordan, because people are not walking around with cameras.
Mm.
And, I was not gawking. I was keeping my head down at checkpoints. I was able to go to Najaf and Fallujah and Ramadi to Karbala, a quick trip to Basra, and maybe 5 or 6 trips to Baghdad. And so we, like I said, saw many old friends, and that was a great joy on the one hand, and also sorrowful on the other hand, to hear doctors. I am a nurse, and so one of the things that really impacted me a great deal was that there's no potable water after 10 years, and there's no national electrical grid. You know, the lights, the electricity kept going down, and that can be quite frightening at night. But this is something that people in Iraq have lived with for years. But the potable water is really a desperate situation. In the hospitals, they have to buy plastic bottled water. People in Baghdad and at least Baghdad and Ramadi and Karbala, and they're fed with different rivers. The Tigris feeds Baghdad and comes through Turkey, and the Euphrates feeds Karbala and Ramadi and comes through Syria. It's more polluted than the Tigris, but they're both quite polluted, and water filter systems are needed, and those are expensive. And so, you know, there are people who go around in different neighborhoods and sell water out of, like, what would you call those, you know, a push card or whatnot, but you're not actually sure what kind of water you're getting. You're taking it on faith. And then if you don't have money even for that, you drink tap water. And then, so one of the hospitals we visited, of the 6 kids in the ward where I was, 3 were there with gastrointestinal symptoms, and the others were there, two others were there with respiratory problems. The air is very polluted, and I had to close my window at times just to sleep at night, because of the generators, and the gasoline is still leaded, and you have paint factories and cement factories and auto emissions and truck emissions. That there are controls, but nothing is, there are laws, but nothing is overseen. So there is a high rise, not only in cancer throughout the country, but also in asthma and respiratory illnesses.
And how does that compare to when you lived there before the invasion?
Well, you know, it's funny. I was thinking back because people were asking me that, and I remember drinking in Baghdad tap water on occasion. I think we also had bought bottled water. Some people needed to be more careful. I seem to have a good constituency. And so I remember drinking the tap water, and I was okay. Saddam, after the first Gulf War, Saddam had the grid, electrical grid, for instance, up and running within 6 months. And here we are 10 years later, and there are still no basic services.
And why hasn't...
But security, Kathleen, is you know, if I may, when I visited a fifth-year university class in English and was invited to sit in on that lecture hall, I was asked to introduce myself after the lecture and who I was. And so I did introduce myself that I had lived 9 years prior in Baghdad for an extended time, and that I saw that there was no water, potable water, and electrical grid. But I said, but I'd really want to hear from you if that would be all right. And there was dead silence in the hall. These were young people, maybe 22, 23 years old, who would have been 13 or 14 at the time of the U.S.-led invasion. And then finally someone trusted themselves to speak, and he said, we have nothing to say. The last years have only been sad ones. But then more silence, and then a young woman did speak up from the middle of the lecture hall, and it was obviously not easy for her. And she said to me, it's not about water and electricity, she said, because I had mentioned those. She said, you've destroyed everything. You've destroyed our country, our ancient civilization. You've destroyed what's inside of us. You've taken our smiles. You've taken our dreams. And then people began to speak, and they said, Iraqis cannot forget what Americans have done. They destroyed our childhood. You don't destroy everything and then say, we're sorry. You don't commit crimes and then say, sorry. Mm-hmm. And then someone else said, we're happy to make bridges between people, but we will not forget. What can you do? In Fallujah, 30% of the babies are born deformed. What can you do?
And why were people hesitant to speak up? Was that...
Well, I think that, number one, there's a graciousness and a hospitality and a welcoming that Iraqis, that is such a part and parcel of people in the Middle East, that they are hesitant to wound you, you know, to be rude. And also, it's a, you know, I often felt that my very presence as someone from the United States opened deep wounds, even though I assured people that there were many people behind me. I was just one person that they saw, but there were many people who didn't want this war, who have trouble sleeping at night because of what they continue to suffer. So that, I always prefaced what I said and explained who I was. They have a right to know who it is that's in their country, you know. So I do feel, and I felt this very much in Jordan and in Syria too, you have to understand, Kathleen, that I'm often the first person, other than U.S. soldiers, that Iraqis have seen, mm-hmm. whether it be in Jordan, Syria, or here in Iraq. So there's a lot of memories. You know, I spoke with one with a very gentle, mild-mannered sheikh, and I asked him, we drove down in the same car to Basra, and I was with a translator. I was able to ask him what he felt the effects of the violence has been on Iraqis, and he responded that Iraqi people were living peacefully, different groups, together side by side until the Iraq-Iran war, and then the wealthy and the poor alike had to go to the front to fight. And this was, he felt, the outbreak of violence. But then he went on to say, we consider the American people, he said, represented by the soldiers who fight the war against us as war criminals. We saw how they were cruel and savage, how tanks ran over innocent people. It became normal for every household to lose loved ones. We saw terrorists whom we caught and handed over to the U.S. troops, later released. Many wrongdoings are credited, he said, to Islam, but the U.S. was wrong to bring terror to Iraq. And he went on to say the Iraqi people are religious and they will become strong and resilient again. Another young woman who acted as my translator 23 years old, was only 13, about 13 when the U.S. war on Iraq broke out, and I asked her how she felt the war had affected her country, and she said, people have changed. And I heard this everywhere I went. People have changed. They think of themselves, she said. It's not good. Things have gotten worse. Children 8 and 10 years old think of weapons and killing. They don't have the thoughts of children. And she said, I would be afraid for my own children growing up in this atmosphere. I've never felt safe since the war, she said. We've forgotten the real meaning of safety. I hope it doesn't get worse because it's my country, and I hope for all the good for it. She said, I'm afraid the level of education is very low, even in the colleges. There was a mass exodus of the professional class, and that has had a big effect, she said, on her generation. But she wants to teach the new generation in the right way, not as her teachers taught her. The good teachers have left the country, she said. I want to do good, to positively affect society. Iraqi people are kind, but after the war, many changes happened in the psyche, she said. And, of course, the corruption is a big thing that I witnessed. There is corruption in every ministry. Corruption, Iraq is number one in the world in bribes. And you can buy your education. You have to buy your job. It's a big problem. It's just a big problem, the corruption. Mm-hmm. You have to buy your way out of prison, even if you're cleared by a judge. You can pay for everything. Everything is up for sale.
Why is that?
This was a big... Well, because of the corruption that's rampant in the country and the ministries. You have to belong to a certain sector or political party to get ahead. And because of the mass exodus, I mean, you know, people... There's still kidnapping going on, but kidnapping was a business for money, too, and assassinations. And so I know from being in Jordan and Syria for so many years that people just fled, you know, because their kids were kidnapped or they were kidnapped. And so the Iraqi refugee population is not like a poor refugee population from an underdeveloped country. You know, these are professional people, many of them. And I was able to meet also with professional people who didn't leave, who are among my heroes. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they were telling me is that, you know, security is better. Violence is more targeted, not as random. And there are more cars and the salaries are better. So outwardly, things appear better, they said. But they were at a very low point because they've been working for such a long time and see no improvement. And they said there was no hope under Saddam and there is no hope now. It is different, they said. We can talk in front of everyone. We are able to speak and even criticize the government, but nothing changes. So I sensed throughout my travels that a deep sense of helplessness and hopelessness because of the corruption and because they just feel unable to change. It's a central government. And, I mean, even the... I was just reading yesterday, that they have... in about 10 days, they're going to have provincial elections. And there's still, because of the high bloodshed, a dozen candidates have already been killed. So only 12 of the country's 8 provinces will go to the polls. So, you know, the war is far from over, and people said this to me, too. One young man, 23 years of age, said to me, the war is not over. In the Iraqi embassy, or the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, there are 15,000 people. What are they doing? Yeah. And I thought, what a good question. In fact, I couldn't believe that, so I researched it. And I've researched it more than once because I couldn't believe it. Every time I write it, I have to Google it. And there's not 15,000, there's 16,000, with another 8,000 security to protect them. And that's our largest embassy in the world. So, and I don't know if, I do keep a note, Kathleen, of in my, when I notice the numbers are higher of roadside, people killed by roadside explosions, by suicide bombs, by bombs in marketplaces and mosques and sticky bombs and whatnot. I rate them down. And just in this year, I just want to read a couple of numbers. 52 killed, 141 wounded on February 17th. 34 killed, 70 wounded on February 28th. March 19th, nearly 100 killed. Another day, 47. Another day, 38. Another day, 41. In January of this year, 177 Iraqis were killed. In February, 136. One figure that we hear a lot of, especially around the 10th year anniversary of the war, one tragic figure, is that we lost 4,486 American troops since the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom, it was called. In the year, last year, 2012, 4,471 Iraqi civilians were killed in the violence. So the war is far from over, but we don't get this information on the media. We don't hear this. Or we don't, you know, we're so now off to Iraq and drone attack, Afghanistan and Pakistan and the drone attacks that we've become insensitized to numbers. We're numb.
Yes, I was going to ask
you
about
that. Another 17 killed, another 34 killed, drone attacks, another. There'll be an investigation. That's what is always said. There'll be an investigation. And then we don't hear anymore.
I'm speaking with Kathy Breen, a volunteer with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She spent time in Iraq in the fall of 2002, and she also stayed on for 5 or 6 months leading up to the invasion, also through the Shock and Awe campaign. She returned to Iraq about 8 months into the occupation for another 3 months. And late last year, October, November of 2012, she returned. And we're talking about what is happening there and what is happening to the people of Iraq still. My feeling, too, is that people think because there was this whole lot of publicity around, oh, we're pulling out, we're getting out, we're out, we're out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like it's a non-issue or something, the whole Iraq situation.
Right. That's right. It's not in the news anymore unless somehow it has to do with oil or Iran. And I want to say the sanctions, do you know, this just blew me away when I visited a hospital in Baghdad for children with cancer, an oncology pediatric unit. There's still no radiation center in Baghdad. There's one, it's the only one in the country that has 60-year-old cobalt radiation machines, 60 years old, and there's like a 6-month waiting list. So some cancer victims are going to Turkey for treatment for radiation. It really is incredible to just imagine that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I guess if I had to describe Baghdad, if I had 3 words to describe it, these would be my words. Checkpoints, traffic jams, and cement barricades. And I took so many pictures of cement barricades and sat in so many roadblocks and checkpoints for hours. And you just have to imagine doing that in 120, 130 degree heat. And I had heard about this, but to be there and take part in that, and the climate was quite pleasant when I was there, but yeah, it's not a pleasant picture, but the people are what give me hope, you know?
Yeah. Where is the hope in this whole thing?
I mean, that's where I draw my hope, in this that people can hold out for such long periods of time in such horrendous circumstances, you know? But, you know, I think they have a deep faith, and they have... I couldn't do it. I know that.
Now, you mentioned just a few days ago the media commemorated the fact that it was the anniversary of the regime change in Baghdad and the toppling of the statue. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and relate your own observations, given that you were there at that time, and now you're hearing the media cover that issue again.
Yeah, we were just, Kathleen, about a block away from where that statue stood that was toppled, and found out later that it was orchestrated. And that image of some Iraqis joyfully springing was shown far and wide. But we were also witnessing the deep, deep sadness in Iraqis who just told us, even before the collapse of the regime, that we won't have an occupied country. Not that they wanted to see Saddam overthrown, but they didn't want an occupied country. They had had that under the British. And so I heard over and over again, Baghdad is finished. Baghdad is finished. People saying to one another, tearfully, Baghdad is finished. And then we were there, too, a short time after that, when the looting began, and when in Baghdad we saw everybody descend from outside, because we have to recall, and I think this is so important in terms of memory, that it was the coalition forces that disbanded the army and also the police, and there were no borders, no border control. Anybody could come in from Saudi Arabia, from Syria, from Kuwait. Anybody came in, and everybody did come in, and we saw them. We saw them, and it like descending on a fallen animal to pick the carcass. And I've always believed this, but I heard it without coaching anyone this time. They said it from themselves, you know. You brought terrorism to this country. You brought the terrorists here to fight the war on terrorism in our country. Because I think we need to note that there was never a suicide bomb before that, before the U.S.-led occupation. There was never al-Qaeda. And now, when we look at the ongoing war and the problems that they're faced, you know, and the violence, the ongoing violence and assassinations and kidnappings, and it's just horrible.
Mm-hmm. Kathy Breen, you plan to return to Iraq next month?
I'm hoping, yes. I'm hoping to be able to go back. We need to be witnesses to what's happening, and voices, if it's possible, for Iraqis who aren't able to travel here themselves and speak for themselves. I'd like to end, if I may, because I think our time is coming to an end, with something that I've quoted quite oftentimes over the years. It's from C.S. Lewis, from the preface of The Great Divorce, and I think it just speaks to our situation here in the United States. And he said, "I do not think that all who choose wrong paths perish, but their rescue consists in being put back on the right road. A sum can be put right, but only by going back till you find the error and working it afresh from that point, never by simply going on. Evil can be undone, but it can't develop into good. Time does not heal it." And so I'm very grateful, Kathleen, to have this opportunity to remember 10 years later what it's like in Iraq, what Iraqis are saying, what they're experiencing. Because we have to, as a country, I believe, go back to where we made the wrong turn in the road and acknowledge that.
Mm. Yeah. The chances of that seem so far away to me, I'm sorry to say.
To us both.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we have to keep trying, right?
Yes, yes.
And listen, I'd be more than happy when I return, please God, to catch up with you again.
Great, I would appreciate that so much. And it's very, very good to be able to speak with you and hear what you have to say from a very unique perspective. So I thank you so much for speaking with us and getting this information out there.
You're very, very welcome.
Be safe in your travels, Kathy. And
thank you, Kathleen.
Okay, and thank you so much.
Thanks for making this easy, Kathleen.
Oh, you're welcome. And is there anything you wanted to say about, you know, where people would get more information or...
Well, they can go to Voices for Creative Nonviolence. It's www.vcnv.org. And they're doing a lot. We're doing a lot around Afghanistan and the drone activity and atrocities, but they also put up my dispatches. So that would be one place to see what Voices is doing.
I've been speaking with Kathy Breen of Voices for Creative Nonviolence about her experiences visiting and staying in Iraq for extended periods of time. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Voices from the Middle East. Thank you for listening.
Good morning. This is Michelle Schroeder Fletcher at KBOO 90.7 FM. And this morning in the studio, we have with us a local small businessman, social activist, concerned parent, musician, environmentalist, and added to the list several years ago, filmmaker Matt Briggs, whose film in its new edited state, and I'm sorry, we're having some mic problems, is playing this Saturday, April 13th, at the Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark. The name of the film is Deep Green, and Matt will be introducing the film and will be able to answer questions following the presentation. So, again, if